We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft on the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. This year, our program, Focus, turned 30, and we've been marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. These are shows that feature some of our most interesting guests and touch on a range of topics, everything from politics to popular culture. In this installment of what we're calling the Deep Archives Project, we have two writers of detective stories, one very old school and one very new, Mickey Spillane and Walter Mosley. Mickey Spillane was the creator of one of America's original tough guy detectives, Mike Hammer, a character that the New York Times Book Review once called an icon of our culture. Mike Hammer first appeared in the novel I, the Jury, that was published in 1947. A dozen others followed, and their popularity made Mickey Spillane one of the best-selling authors of the 20th century. We talked in 1996, just after Spillane published what turned out to be his last Mike Hammer novel, Black Alley. And when we began the conversation, Spillane said he didn't write detective stories, he wrote mystery adventure. So I asked him to explain the difference between the two, and he began by talking about another writer, Earl Stanley Gardner, the man who created Perry Mason.
Well, Earl Stanley Gardner wrote detective stories. I write mystery adventure, which is, gives you a lot more latitude to have fun when you're writing it, and encompasses a lot more than just plain detective technique, police technique, in other words. I can expand into love, romance, you know, adventure, and all the good stuff.
Yeah, and you think that a detective novel, somehow that it's too confining, you can't?
Well, for me it is. It wasn't for Earl Stanley Gardner. That was his technique, and that's what the people liked. And I got my readers, so they liked both of them. I always loved Earl Stanley Gardner, too.
Who are some of the other writers that you particularly like and you think may have influenced your own style of writing?
I don't say anybody influenced my style of writing. When I was younger, one of the great writers was... I can't think of his name. He wrote the Race Williams stories. John Carroll Daly, that's who it was. And he was he never could write a book properly, but he was a great magazine writer. Now, I started off in the magazine business years ago, and I started off with the Slicks. I worked my way down to the Pulps, then down to the Comics, which was working way down in class, but up financially, because I made more money out of Comics than I ever made out of Saturday Evening Post or Collier's. So there are different areas for writing. And if you can get along in any one of them, you're in good shape. But I stayed with the mystery field. I found out from my way of writing, that's where I could make the most.
You were a police reporter at one point?
I did a lot of that work. I worked for King Features for quite a while back there. Now we're going back pre-war times. And some of the stuff was right after World War II. But actually, I'm in business. I tell everybody I am not an author. I'm a writer, and I work for money. So, you know, I don't know why people want to be authors anyway. Being a writer, you cover every phase of the field that there is, and it's a very exciting business, and if you do it right and you're there at the right time, you can make a good piece of change.
Well, you're lucky because, you know, there are writers who have never been able, you know, probably a lot of authors, a lot of published authors, couldn't support themselves just on what they make.
I know,
from their
it's horrible. They're not good. That's why they can't do it. If they were good, they'd pick out the right area to work in and do the job there. As I say, too many people want to be authors.
When you were a police reporter, were there things that you saw for real that ended up one way or another being in your books?
No, I use a lot of people. And I use a lot of incidents, but I don't bother trying to do any kind of research into crime work or actually the visual things that you see, the same thing policemen see. You see a lot of blood and guts and all that sort of stuff, but you'll notice something when you watch cops at a crime scene, they're so cut and dry because that's their work. I might be the first dead person you've ever seen. They have seen dozens of them, and they're talking baseball while they're doing an investigation on a body. It's a different world entirely when you're enmeshed in that type of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't do it anymore. I sort of write pure fiction.
What is the character based at all on anybody that you met? Are there real people that helped to inspire the qualities that ended up making Mike Hammer?
No, but I use real people in my book. I used to use Hy Gardner, who was a great columnist for the Tribune, had his own big TV show in New York and Miami. I will use real people, and I will use them. I'll describe them as they actually are, but you have to watch out for using real people so it doesn't come back on you. I've used a lot of crooks and bad guys they couldn't very well come back at me for doing it. But I still stay with fiction. You get a story in your mind. I don't believe that old saying that truth is stranger than fiction. That's not so. Fiction is a lot stranger than truth because you can do what you want with it.
Yeah. When you start out, do you have, how well developed is the idea for the story?
No, it's not at all. I write the ending first. It's like the punchline on a joke. This is the biggest part about it. You listen to all the garbage that goes along first to get to the punchline. When I get a good ending, I know what the ending's going to be. I write that, and then I write from the beginning on up to the ending. And then I got a nice, fresh ending to slap on that book. I've told a lot of people about that, and I know some writers that have been trying it that way. And I've known a few older guys who did it that way. Now, when we were writing comics, that's the way we wrote them, at least the way I wrote them anyway.
Hmm. Well, what do you think it was about, either about the character or about your style, that grabbed people?
Well, there's a couple of things that happened. When I was in the military during World War II, I saw something new happening, and that was the advent of the paperback books. At that time, they only reprinted things like Moby Dick, and Alexander Dumas and all these things. But I said, this is the new marketplace. So when I wrote Ida Jury, I did not write it for hardback. I wrote that to be published in reprint. But there was no way of getting it to reprint unless it went through the hardback. Now, in hardback, it didn't sell worth a hoot. But the minute it hit the public sale in reprint, it went right to the top. Hmm. And it stayed that way. Now the tail wags the dog. Signet bought the original hardbook house of E.P. Dutton, and now they're Penguin Books. So the whole market has changed around since those days.
One of the things that I was thinking about in anticipating talking to you, I was thinking about the TV series that was made based on the character of some years back, this series that starred Stacy Keach.
Yeah, there was one before that with Darren McGavin.
And, I know there was one before that. That maybe, I guess, was a little before my time. So the one I know is the more recent one. Well, one of the things I was thinking about was the way that they played that character, and I don't know how you felt about it, but it seemed like they played the character as a guy who was somehow not quite in his time. That is, he was from a different time.
Yeah, I keep writing that. I'm always I go back to years ago. I still have a carryover, the character, which he still opens the door for women. He might be a male chauvinist, but he's a nice guy. I am not Art Deco type, you know. The modern age is a little bit strange for me.
Well, that's what the book really has a. I hesitate to say old-fashioned because that sounds really
negative. That's a good
negative
word to use. I think it's all right.
Well, it is. It's in the sense that it's a kind of a style, a kind of a feeling that you don't really see anymore, and it's just what you've always done.
I haven't changed my style any. I've gone into different directions. That's about all.
Yeah.
You know, I never wrote about a really bad guy. He's a bad guy. He was a nice guy with rough edges, and I still keep him that way.
He has kind of a vigilante streak, though.
Yeah, I like that.
Well, that's another one of the.
We need that to these days.
One of the things that's been said about your writing when Mike Hammer came along, that it was a departure from some of the characters that we'd seen before, in that he was felt that he was kind of a law unto himself.
I got torn apart by the critics like nobody's ever. It's unbelievable. But that's perfectly all right, as long as the public doesn't do it. The public enjoyed the character. I don't pay any attention to critics anyway. They get free books. Let them say what they want.
That is one of the great things about being a critic, isn't it? Yeah, you don't have to pay for any of your reading.
They can say what you please. You know, there was a great... Anthony Butcher from the New York Times used to chop me apart. And before he died, he apologized. He said I was his favorite writer. And what really got him annoyed was the fact that the public never listened to him. So I don't call the people who read my book, I don't call them fans. I call them customers. And when you're nice to your customers, they'll come back to you.
Well, obviously, the people must like it because your books have continued to sell.
Incidentally,
really
they're 200 million, not 160.
Oh, my apologies. I get that from your publisher.
I know. They don't know. They don't even know me. How can they know how many books I've sold? I was up there yesterday, and I didn't know anybody in the place. I used to be pretty well-known in my publishing house, but I've outlived everybody. And everybody's so darn young. Good grief.
Well, they're still interested in publishing your book, so...
Oh, sure.
There's that.
They're all nice people, but they look at me like, who's that old buck down here?
Well, your book, this particular book, and I promise you I won't be giving away a lot of stuff, but the book opens with the character Mike Hammer having been involved in shootout. He's shot up, and he's very lucky that he lives.
That's right.
I'm really struck by the fact that here's a character who maybe is coming to grips with what he's been through and with his age.
Right.
The fact that he's not young anymore, and he's not
46. I'm never going to let him get over that 46.
46.
See, that was the same age I was when I played him in the movie. And I was when I played the Mike Hammer part in The Girl Hunters. And, I'm almost 79 now. You know, he's not a little off an ante, but I can't let him get old.
So you're never, Mike Hammer is never going to die?
Heroes never die. John Wayne isn't dead, you know.
Well, it seems like I see him every time I turn on the TV.
Isn't that true?
So were you intentionally, exploring this idea of the character trying to come to grips with his mortality?
No. If you're going to play around those games, you're going to get hit every once in a while. Something bad's going to happen to you. Even if you'd known, you might not be doing a special job. You'll fall off the front step someday, get ice on that. So these are things that can happen to a person in real life and can happen to them in a book. But it gives them there's a sense of reality there. You expect a guy to get... Every time you watch a guy get beaten up on TV, and he gets right up off the floor, and you know he never got hit. It's not real. But you can read about it. When a guy gets shot, he gets hurt.
Yeah.
And it lasts for a while. But they can overcome all those things and wind up in the end being a winner again.
I'm just curious about what you think about and now all the concern people have about violence in media and the way that it's presented. And maybe one of the things that people say is the problem with violence is that people never really get to see the real consequences. Like you say, people get beat up pretty badly and then they just get up and walk away. And that somehow, if you're going to show that violence, then you really also ought to show what it's really like.
Well, I'm on your side with this. Now, I don't like the violence that you see on TV. I'll tell you why. It spoils the story. One of the things that's very important story-wise is impending violence. You see it's going to happen, but it does. You're trying to forestall it. Now, this can make it go into good storylines. But sheer action stuff, now it gets into special effects. They're throwing blood all over the place. You're watching the bullets hit, you see the blood spurt out. Back in the old days, they just grabbed their chest, spun around, and hit the deck. But it spoils the storytelling. Now, there are ways of doing things. You can have one big shootout. That's good. But you can't have them continually throughout a story. You're losing time. You know what blank time is on TV or radio? You can't stand that. It's not good for anybody. It turns your listener off. You you know, product managers go, you know, hey, what's happening there? Blank time.
Mm-hmm.
But now they fill in blank time with blood violence, and it's not a good thing to see. It spoils the story.
Something else I noticed, it really struck me in reading Black Alley, is that there is virtually no profanity in this book. Damn is about the worst thing anybody says.
Yeah, that's all I ever used to say. I never use profanity, mainly because I don't use it myself. And you really don't have to do that in a story. Sometimes in dialogue you might want to do it. But it gets kind of nasty and it spoils the tone of your book. I laid off it, nobody paid any attention to it. Except I've had some people say, you know, I'm glad you didn't do that because everybody else is going awfully heavy into wild dialogue.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the other things that about the book that sets it apart. It's the way people talk. You don't have the kind of rough language that you see now virtually every place, including on television. Now the kind of things that people say on TV.
Oh, gee, I get insulted by what I hear on TV. And, you know, it's bad enough hearing that stuff on the street without having to listen to it come across the tubes.
So was your decision, I mean, was that a sort of a moral thing, or was it just that you didn't, something about it just didn't rub you the wrong way?
It, so I'm not going to use it. It didn't change the tone of the story at all. I mean, there are times when you don't have to use it, and why? I mean, if you try to establish a character, you can do it without using lousy language.
Was there ever a time, were there times when you you thought to yourself maybe that you ought to, it would be good to somehow modernize the character and bring it, you know, more into, make him more of a man of the 90s?
How would you do that?
Well, I don't know. Maybe that would destroy the, maybe you couldn't.
Well, you know, a nice guy is a nice guy under any conditions. A lousy guy is a lousy guy in any conditions. People don't change. I mean, I can have a character with rough edges, and he stays that way. But there's no way you can really phony up a character, because the only thing that happens to you is you get older. You know, your mind can stay in one vein, but your body isn't. And, you know, I at my age now, I'm not jumping off any roofs anymore.
You did before?
I did before, yeah. I was pretty physical in all things, but my golly, I bought a football about a month ago, a new football, rubber one. The player was on the beach. I said, look at that, what am I going to do with this thing now? But Hurricane Hugo had floated my other ball out of the way, and I never had a football around to play with. And I saw that one, I said, that's exactly what I want. I bought it. And I said, look, who am I going to throw this thing to? My arm's not that good anymore. And luckily, I had a granddaughter that liked to play ball with me, so we throw the ball around once in a while. I go in skiing. I go in Chicken Little Hill. All the kids are. But even then, it's all in your mind. Everything is mental anymore. I have to sit back and dream of the days when I did all these things.
One of the things that I guess some people have been critical about over the years is women, the way women appear in your writing.
Women are beautiful. All my women are beautiful.
Well, I'm interested in the particularly the character of Velda.
Yeah.
Mike Hammer's secretary.
She was a woman. Velda was a regular woman. Her name originally was Wilma.
And where did Velda come from?
Well, I made it up to sound like Wilma. Wilma's dead now. But that was she was my inspiration for Velda.
And who was she?
The girl I was engaged to when I went into the military.
Uh-huh. What was she like?
Just like Velda.
Well, what I think is interesting about Velda is that, unlike a lot of detectives have secretaries. You know, you've got to have somebody to answer the phone and keep track of your appointments and run errands and stuff like that. But she's also a private investigator. She's licensed to carry a gun.
She is.
She's a lot more than just somebody who answers the telephone.
Oh yeah, sure. Because, you know, if you're in your office by yourself, you answer the phone. Whoever else is there, they'll answer the phone. But no, she has a regular, she's got her own life to lead inside the book. And now I'm going to get her more tightly involved with Mike. But you're not going to know about it until you read the next book.
So are they going to get married?
I'm not going to tell you. It's a possibility.
That is one of the things. Well, in Black Alley, this is after he's had this brush with death and comes back and sees her for the first time after almost dying. He proposes.
It's a new person to him. You got a whole new life to go. You see, this is the fun of writing. You can change their characters and their characterizations and give them something brand new that nobody ever thought about before. And they can take a new attitude toward it. Now, here's something funny. You know, you watch TV and you watch a good soap opera and you're seeing adultery, fornication, everything just right in front of your face all the time. Nobody gets married. And yet the greatest sexual activity you can find is between married people. You know what? And there's another thing that people don't know. I try to tell this to people. I think it's funny, but one of the great sex moves that a couple could ever have is holding hands. Man, this is real. Your hands are so expressive, you know, and nobody pays any attention to it. Think about it once.
Well, I think you're right. You're kind of dating yourself there, but
I'm not going to tell you anymore. I'll let you learn for yourself.
One of the advantages of having a character and writing about that character over a long period of time and over a number of books is that you and then your readers feel that they have some history. That is, they understand that person's history, and you can see how over time the character changes as a result of the different experiences that he has. So I guess that's one of the great advantages of doing a series and doing it with the same character.
Well, let me tell you something funny. Mike Hammer gets as much fan mail as I get. People write to him like he's a real person. You'd be surprised at the number of letters I get from prisoners who write to Mike Hammer and give him information because they have been falsely imprisoned and want him to get them out.
Well, you know, I've heard that people do write letters to Sherlock Holmes still.
Oh, yeah. But those are usually old people, and they're a little staggered in their imagination. But these are real people.
And they think that Mike Hammer is also a real person.
They think he's real. Stacy Keach is starting to get mail like that, too. And he's on television. But Mike Hammer, the letters come right to me. It's a strange thing. But
and they're mostly people who are looking to hire him or looking for
They're looking for
help?
Him to help them out. They haven't got any money, you know. But I'm always a little bit, not shocked, but amazed that the people think that here's a real character.
Well, that's a great tribute to the character and to you.
It makes me think I'm a pretty good writer.
Well, I would think that would make, if it was me, I think the same thing.
Well, so I write back and I try to explain things, but then they'll write back to me as if they're talking to Mike Hammer again. It's hard to explain this. I have to be sitting in my own shoes and get the letters and read these things. Not counting what the women do. Gee whiz.
Oh, yeah? Like what?
Send pictures.
Graphic?
I'm not going to talk anymore.
Graphic pictures? I'm now starting to imagine what kind of pictures we're talking about. You mean those kind of pictures?
Oh, man. Some of these people, I'm surprised they can read.
We have a couple of minutes left. So, sometimes one of the things that has happened with a character, a really popular character, is that after the person who created the character is not around anymore, somebody else has then come along and picked it up and continued to write.
That's terrible. I don't like
you
that.
You wouldn't want somebody else, after you were gone, to be writing Mike Hammer novels?
Absolutely not. I've already I have a contingency program for that. It's not going to happen to me.
So it's actually some kind of legal deal that says nobody else can use the name or the
That's right. The character dies with me. They can reprint any stories they want, but nobody's going to write under my name. And I haven't got a kid who has the same name I have either. I got one Michael Spillane, but that's a different name.
So you even somebody who was that close to you, you wouldn't want them to...
No, that's good. You can't do that. That'd be like having somebody do a Van Gogh again, you know. You can't go out and imitate somebody's works that everybody liked. And when what's his name, did 007.
Ian Fleming.
Yeah, but he died. They started picking his stuff up and doing that. It wasn't the same. You know, they shouldn't do things like that. However, business will do the funniest things possible, and there is a big business we're involved with here. But I don't want that to happen to me.
Yeah. Well, there's no shortage of people who are writing, who are creating this kind of character. So, I mean, I think there are probably countless people who have imitated your style.
They're not around all day very long, though. You can't imitate and stay in the public eye very long. It's got to be original.
And he certainly was. Mickey Spillane, he was a guest on Focus 580, November 1996, just after the publication of his last Mike Hammer novel, Black Alley. Mickey Spillane died in 2006. This year, our program turned 30, and we're celebrating that by digging into our tape collection, looking for interesting people with things to say about important subjects. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project, and we'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Ted Danson. He co-stars in the HBO comedy series Bored to Death, which just began its third season. Danson is now also co-starring in the CBS series CSI, Crime Scene Investigation. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign County Developmental Disabilities and Mental Health Boards, presenting the 5th Annual Reaching Out for Answers Disability Resources Expo at Lincoln Square Village on Saturday, October 22nd from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. The expo features over 65 exhibitors and entertainment for the whole family.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. In the second part of today's Deep Archive Mystery Doubleheader, we have a conversation with Malter Mosley. He's a very prolific writer of mysteries, science fiction, also nonfiction, dealing with politics and social issues. He's probably best known for a character that he created named Easy Rawlins, who first appeared in 1990 in the novel Devil in a Blue Dress. He followed that with 10 more books, including a prequel, Gone Fishin', that tells some of Easy Rawlins' backstory. When I talked with Malter Mosley in 2005, his book Cinnamon Kiss had just come out. I asked him to talk about how his character, Easy Rawlins, had changed over the course of the series.
Well, you know, Easy's changed in a lot of ways. One way, he's just gotten older. He's 46 years old now. He's only 28 in Devil in a Blue Dress. And, of course, in Gone Fishin', he's only 19. He's changed as a man growing older. While he's been changing, the world around him has changed. So, you know, in 1948, there's like a deep chasm between white and black in America. And Easy lives in a black world, and his relationship with white people is almost always the same because of America and America's history. By 1966, especially after the Watts riots, all of that is mixed up. His relation to other black people, his relation to white people, is changed greatly. But one of the more interesting things about Easy, though, are ways in which he doesn't change or can't change. He's still a child of the 1920s in the Deep South in many ways. And so his understanding of the world can't be freed up enough for him to do certain kinds of things. So, you know, for instance, Jackson Blue's girlfriend, Jewel, knows much more about real estate than Easy and is much better at it because she's not limited by the history of who she has to be in the world. Yeah. And so some of the ways what's interesting about Easy is how he's changed. And in other ways, it's how the world has changed, but he has been unable to make those transitions.
So it raises an interesting idea, and that is, in one sense, an author creates a character, and you would say, well, you can, because you created that character, you can do anything you like with him or her. And though the fact of the matter is that once you've created the character and provided them with a world to live in and with certain sorts of experiences, then that places limits on what you can do with that character.
Absolutely.
You can't do anything you want.
No, you can't. I mean, really, it's absolutely true. There are things that you can't make out of him, and this is not going to happen. And if you did it, wouldn't sound true. The novel wouldn't sound like it's making sense, especially if you know the whole history of it. But even in a singular book, it wouldn't make sense. you'd have to start changing his history in some kind of way to make him a completely different person.
Hmm. What led to the creation of these other characters that inhabit the same world, in a sense, Fearless Jones, Paris Mint, and Socrates Fortlaw?
Well, you know, Socrates is very different, I think. You know, I mean, certainly it's not really a crime series in any way. It's more a kind of fictional philosophy series, I guess, is the only thing I could really say about it, because, you know, Socrates really is a philosopher, and that's how I'm developing him. But the thing is that the thing that they all have in common, of course, is that they're black male heroes. In a literary landscape where there are almost no black male heroes. I mean, there are a lot of black male protagonists and antagonists, but there are not a lot of black male heroes. I mean, you know, those kind of heroic characters, you know, David Copperfield, you know, or James Bond, or, you know, whatever kind of one you want to talk about, the characters that you identify with and who give you hope for, you know, a future or possibility in the world. And the only thing that I do is write about black male heroes. So you have everybody, Paris and Fearless and Easy, even Mouse, Socrates Fortlow. But through all my books, I'm talking about that because there's such a vacuum there.
When you set out to write the first novel, this in the late 1980s, the novel that became Devil in a Blue Dress, did you right away, did you have this impulse to write in this genre?
Oh, no. The first book, by the way, is Gone Fishing. That's the first book I wrote. Nobody wanted to publish it.
Oh.
I was writing a book about that migration, a series of books, not unlike, I was like thinking about Zola, you know, writing a series about a group of people something happens to. I'm writing about this group of people who move from the Deep South into California, and what does that mean from Texas and Louisiana? And, you know, I wrote the first book and nobody wanted to publish it. And the notion was that, well, you know, white people didn't read about black people, black women didn't like black men, and black men didn't read, so who's going to read your book? It didn't bother me all that much. And I started writing another book, and that was Devil in a Blue Dress. I didn't realize until I was halfway through the book that it was going to be a mystery. And, you know, then I went, wow, it's a mystery. And people seem to like that very much.
So that in a way, though, the thing that is in all of these books, the experience of being black in America and being a black man, the thing that you just can't get away from because obviously the characters can't get away from that, that's I'm wondering in how direct a way did that start out being something that you said, no matter what else I'm doing here, this is going to be something that I know I want to be writing about in a very direct
way. Well, the answer to that question is, I didn't realize I was doing it until I wrote Black Betty.
Huh.
When I finished writing Black Betty, I looked at it and I was, you know, and I was on tour. And somebody says, so what is the subject of all your novels? Somebody asked that, you know, kind of insightful question. And I went, oh, black male heroes. And I said it, not completely believing it even. And the next day, I went, you know, that was true. It really is. That really is what I'm doing here.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is novelist Walter Mosley. He has written a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction. And as I said at the beginning, probably people will know him best for the series of crime novels that revolve around this character named E.Z. Rawlins. And the first one of those books was Devil in a Blue Dress. It was published in 1990, was made into a movie starring Denzel Washington. He has now published the 10th book in this series. The title is Cinnamon Kiss. It's published by Little Brown. It is out now. And, of course, all the other books are in print. You might be interested in reading those. You might be interested in sampling some of his science fiction. He's written a number of different kinds of things. Questions here are welcome, too. And we have a couple of people who'd like to talk with the guest. Both callers are in Urbana. We'll start with line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Mosley on how he developed the voice. I believe that's the correct term. Every one of us writes in a particular voice. And was it something that developed for him, shall we say, in a natural way, or is this something that he has been identifying for his particular character?
So that question is like the voice for the E.Z. Rawlins novels, because I think probably there are different voices for different books I write. I mean, and they're, you know, because, I mean, like, for instance, I'll write the Fearless Jones series, and that's from the point of view of a guy named Paris Minton. You know, Paris is a very different guy than E.Z. Rawlins. he's small and he's kind of cowardly and he's a bookworm. And he doesn't have a lot of, it's not that he doesn't care about people around him, it's just that he doesn't care enough to do anything to help them. He's usually only helping himself. So that's a very different kind of character than E.Z. Rollins. But the thing is, I don't really think about that when I'm writing. I just start writing. And the thing is that when you're writing a book, the most important thing is narrative voice. And the most important thing in narrative voice is the consistency of that voice. And so once you start writing, you follow how that character is, you know, thinking, talking, responding, reacting. And when you're rewriting, you make sure that it always is the same character doing that. If you all of a sudden make this character talk in a very different way or think in a very different way, it stands out. And you have to get rid of it or change it into something else.
Well, thank you very much. That was very helpful.
All right. Thanks for the call. I read that one of the things that you do when you're working is after you have written a section, you actually read it out loud into a tape recorder and play it back and listen to it because you want to hear what it sounds like when it's read out.
Actually, not a section, the whole book. What I do is I've written the whole book, and then I may go through 10 or 12 drafts of the book. And at that point, I know intellectually that I'm not really seeing the words anymore. After you read something enough times, you stop reading the words. You know what they are already. So you're only looking really for cues. And so you may be making really big mistakes. The other thing is, of course, to understand that voice and also to understand how the novel reads. Reading it out loud is an incredible help.
As I have read many of the comments that you've made when people have asked you about writing, you have said things along the line that you feel that you write just because you're compelled to do it. I think one quote was you said, "The reason I'm a writer is because I'm a writer." That is what you are. That is what you do. But you came to it seemingly in a kind of an indirect way. You went to college and studied political science, and you worked for a while in computer programming. When you started writing, I'm interested in what was going on at the time that you actually started writing and whether there was anything in particular that got you started or that you were thinking about trying to do at that point.
Probably. Probably that's true. I was going through a period of my life where I was a computer programmer, and not for a while. I'd been for a long time. Off and on for 15 years, I'd been a programmer. And I enjoyed it okay each day. I didn't want to get to my end of my life and look at the end of it and see me having been a programmer all those years, however. And I wanted to do something else. I always wanted to be an artist. It's not that I thought I was good in anything. I wanted to do something creative because that's what I enjoyed the most in life and in the world. And I had tried many things. I tried drawing. I tried pottery. I tried to learn a musical instrument. And none of it really worked. And one day I was sitting there at work. It was a Saturday, and I just wrote that sentence, which you may have also come across. On hot, sticky days in southern Louisiana, the fire ants swarmed. Now, I knew it sounded good enough to be the beginning of a novel because I'd read a lot of novels, and so I liked that. And it sounded creative because I'd never been to Louisiana, and I'd never seen a fire ant. But I still had a feeling of them in the sentence. And so I said, well, let me try this now. And I just started writing.
One of the things that I have read, and you can tell me whether it's true or not, is that when you were started to work on Devil in a Blue Dress, that your idea was to write a novel that could be the basis for a screenplay. And I don't know if that's true.
I was thinking that because I had read about Graham Greene. I've almost forgotten that. But Graham Greene saying when they asked him to write The Third Man, he decided he would write the novel first to see, to see what it would be like. And then he went to write the screenplay. And I don't know if that was true or not, but I read it. And I think he wrote it in the introduction to The Third Man. And so I thought, wow, that's great. That's fantastic. I'm going to do something like that. So kind of fooling myself into being able to write a novel.
Well, I wonder if somehow in your mind that it shaped the way that you wrote the novel, that whether you thought that it was in any way cinematic or there was something about the way that you approached images or anything in the way that you wrote it.
Not really. Mm-hmm. Because I had no idea what writing screenplay was. Mm-hmm. And I didn't go out and look into it or anything. I didn't research it. I think that probably there's certain elements of my writing which is influenced by a cinematic aesthetic. Because, you know, I'm of a generation that has, you know, spent every day, every part of every day with some kind of, you know, television or movie input. But I don't think that the books are particularly easily transferable into film, or that I give that a lot of consideration. Hmm.
What did you think about the movie version of A Devil
in the Dress? Oh, I loved
it.
That was great. Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful film. And all the acting, all the directing, the cinematography, everything about it was wonderful.
You said that when you were writing Devil in a Blue Dress, it was you were some way into the book before you realized it was a mystery.
Yeah.
And, of course, now you're really well known, as even though you've worked in different genres and you have written some science fiction. I think people think of you as being a mystery writer, and then there inevitably will be comparisons to other mystery writers, for example. And it may just have something to do with the fact that the books are set in Los Angeles, but it seems that often you're compared to Raymond Chandler, for example.
Yeah.
Do you see anything in that, or are there other mystery writers that you particularly identify with or whose work appeals to you?
Yeah, my relationship to Chandler is kind of, it's like a negative release, you know? You have Chandler writing about one Los Angeles and one kind of guy, and I'm writing about the other L.A. and the other kind of guy. So I'm like, you know, it's good to compare me to Chandler because we hardly at all touch the same ground. And then when we do, it's kind of an interesting spark. You know, this is the part of Los Angeles that what was Chandler's character's name? I forgot it.
Sam Spade. Sam Spade.
No,
that's Dashiell Hammett.
Hammett. Doesn't matter. it's the part of town where he wouldn't go. You know, but I'm not sure that there's anything. There's much. You know. Yeah, you know, Chandler's a very flowery writer. It's interesting. You know, I like Ross McDonald a lot more than I like Chandler, because you know McDonald, yeah, there's an economy to his language that's just extraordinary, and there's an attention to his, especially his similes, which are just so perfect. One of his books, I don't remember which one. There's a guy has knocked out Lou Archer and it hasn't tied up and. Watcher looks at him, and he's afraid of him because he looks so calm. And he says, "He was calm, like an adobe wall in moonlight." And when I read that sentence, I'm like, "Oh my God, it's so beautiful, it's so perfect, and it's so California." It was like it was everything. The whole book was in that one little simile. I was 17 years old. I remember reading it and being so moved by it.
Yeah. It strikes me that this sort of style of writing, the hard-boiled detective novel, it's something that, well, at least it's been parodied an awful lot, and it strikes me as it's something that's easy to do badly and hard to do well.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether, in fact, you know, there are times when you, and that must be true of everybody. There are times when you write something and initially you think that's really great, and you go back and look at it, and you think, what did I think was great about that? And so you tear it up.
Hopefully, before I publish the book, I have that idea. But sometimes not. Sometimes later on, I go, oh my God, this is in print. I'll just turn the page quickly, ignore it. I'm not a hard-boiled writer. Neither was Chandler. I don't think McDonald was either. Hammett's a hard-boiled writer. The really, you know. And he says things like, "I hit him with the door repeatedly." That's a hard-boiled line. It's funny. It's mean. It's violent. You know, that's hard-boiled. I'm not a hard-boiled writer. I write crime stories. They're noir to a certain degree. They have other elements to them. My stories are very political, for instance, usually. But we all kind of live in the same neighborhood. You know, that's all. We don't live in the same house.
I'd like to have you talk a little bit about another prominent character that runs through this Easy Rollin series, and that's his friend Raymond Alexander, the man whose nickname is Mouse. In the book, in Cinnamon Kiss, someone is talking to Easy, and she says, of Easy, she says, "You're the most dangerous man in any room you're in." Maybe because in detective novels, people who bump into the detective sometimes end up dead. But if you're talking about the guy who's the most dangerous man in any room he's in, I would think that'd be much more true of Mouse than that would of Easy.
Well, Mouse is more of a threat than Easy. Mouse is a physical threat He's like, he will kill you.
Yes.
You know, but he's probably not going to look at you. The thing is that you could be in a room with mouse, and he will leave if you leave him alone. He'll leave you alone. That's the rule of thumb. But Easy, even if he's helping you, like if Easy is, if you come to Easy, you have a problem, and he saves your life, you would have been better off dead. That's what Edame meant. Easy is a real existentialist hero, and you have to deal with the tragedy of the human condition if you're going to deal with Easy. And so even Mouse and Little Yellow Dog, trying to stay, you know, trying to keep up with Easy, got shot so bad he almost died.
Yeah.
Even Mouse. So Easy is really, he is a danger. Now, Mouse, he's another character. Easy is the hero of the novel because he tells the story. But Mouse is the hero of Easy's world. And why is he a hero? He's a hero. I mean, he's a sociopath. He's a murderer. He's a criminal. He's a philanderer, if such a word would fit him. But the truth is that he's the only black man around who's not afraid of anything. As most black men know, you have to spend your life, if you're going to survive, you have to spend your life being worried about things. Who's that behind me? Who's that in front of me? Why is that door unlocked? Oh, there are the police. What is my wife doing? What is my best friend doing? All you have to worry all the time. Mouse doesn't worry about anything, ever. He is a man who's not afraid. And that makes him a great man, not only for black people, by the by. And so he becomes, he gains this kind of heroic status because he's like everybody's hope.
I think he's an interesting character because his functions in the story seem to be multiple, and on one level, sort of on a superficial level, a lot of mystery and crime fiction, the detective's got to have backup. So Mouse is as Easy's backup, but also he's in such an interesting character for the reasons that you cite, because he's a character of great dark depths, and he functions as a foil, as an offset, as a contrast in a lot of ways to Easy. So he's a very important character, and for more reasons just then, detectives got to have somebody that they can lean on who's going to be there when they need extreme force to be applied.
Yeah, it's true. Though it often turns out that Easy ends up having to take care of himself. I mean, it's a funny situation that Mouse helps him out sometimes, it's true. But more times than not, he doesn't. In the final moment, Easy has to rely on himself, you know. And so the relationship is a funny one. Mouse and the people who are threatened by him depend much more on Easy than Easy depends on Mouse.
I know you read comments that make it really obvious that to you, you would like the readers to respond to the characters that you create like they were real people. And in fact, I read one story that I liked where this must have happened some time ago, because I think it was in regards to Devil in a Blue Dress, that you had done a book signing or doing a talk or something, and somebody came up to you and said that they were really looking forward to reading the next book in the series because Easy had done something that so upset them that he wanted to try to understand better why.
Yeah.
And here he was responding to your character like he was a real guy and was really bothered by something he had done and really wanted to understand. How do you go about, or what do you think is important to creating a character in your writing that people will respond to that way, like they're real?
You create a character. This is a kind of a technical answer. You create a character who, in his pedestrian life, people who read can identify with, how he likes to keep his bedroom clean, what he expects from his children, how he's uncertain in very kind of everyday kind of situations, in a cafe, on the job, etc. And then you transpose that character into a very kind of dynamic, dramatic situation in which this character, who the person who has identified with, now sees this person dealing with stuff that the reader may think about but tries to avoid, or it doesn't end up in those situations. And so then you have the reader kind of taken up in the wake of this character who they identify with and either respect or have deep feeling for, depending on, you know, I mean, you might not respect Miles, but you're going to have deep feeling for him. So then later on, when that character, after you've done that, people begin to identify with that character. It says, well, it's like I know him because, you know, he's like me. I did that, or my father did that, or my cousin did that. And so they become part of their lives. And in becoming part of their lives, they begin to have expectations and concerns about that character. I think that's like, you know, it's kind of like a, you know, like fiction writing 101, but there is no fiction writing 101. Nobody ever teaches it.
We are indeed just about at the point where we have to stop. How much further do you see your stories about E.Z. Rawlins going?
I'd like him to get about 80.
So you think it's possible to bring him to the, will he see to the year 2000?
He'll see the year 2000.
What else now is coming soon? You have managed to produce an amazing amount of work. You must work all the time.
Every day, and not all the time, but every day.
So you do write every day.
Every day, yeah. The books that are coming out, I'll say really quickly. In November, I have I've kind of did a deconstruction of Fantastic Four number one, and Marvel's publishing that in November. In January, I have a science fiction book called The Wave, and the political. A monograph called Life Out of Context. In May, I have a parable called Fortunate Son, and 6 months after that, the new Fearless Jones novel. And then finally, I guess I just made the deal today, I have a book called Killing Johnny Fry, which, for lack of a better term, is a sex novel.
This you expect this to be very controversial? It's an erotic, to say the least. It's an erotic novel.
To say the least, erotic. Erotic means it leaves something to your imagination. This book, at least in 25% of it, leaves nothing to your imagination. I don't know. I hope that people get upset about it. I don't know. Maybe not.
That's Walter Mosley. He was a guest on our show. Back then we called it Focus 580 in October of 2005. He's the author of the best-selling E.Z. Rawlins mysteries. The first book in that series was Devil in a Blue Dress. That was published in 1990. And the most recent is Blonde Faith, and that book came out in 2007. This year, our show turned 30, and we've been celebrating by digging into our collection of interviews, looking for some interesting people with things to say about important subjects. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project. You can tell us what you think by dropping us a line. Go to the Focus section of our webpage near the top. You'll find a place you can leave a comment, or you can write to us at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois, and the zip code is 61801.
And Marvel's publishing that in November. In January, I have a science fiction book called The Wave and the political monograph called Life Out of Context. In May, I have a parable called Fortunate Son, and 6 months after that, the new Fearless Jones novel. And then finally, I guess I just made the deal today, I have a book called Killing Johnny Fry, which, for lack of a better term, is a sex novel.
This you expect this to be very controversial? It's an erotic, to say the least. It's an erotic novel.
To say the least, erotic. Erotic means it leaves something to your imagination. This book, at least in 25% of it, leaves nothing to your imagination. I don't know. I hope that people get upset about it. I don't know. Maybe not.
That's Walter Mosley. He was a guest on our show. Back then we called it Focus 580 in October of 2005. He's the author of the best-selling E.Z. Rawlins mysteries. The first book in that series was Devil in a Blue Dress. That was published in 1990. And the most recent is Blonde Faith, and that book came out in 2007. This year, our show turned 30, and we've been celebrating by digging into our collection of interviews, looking for some interesting people with things to say about important subjects. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project. You can tell us what you think by dropping us a line. Go to the Focus section of our webpage near the top. You'll find a place you can leave a comment, or you can write to us at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois, and the zip code is 61801.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
That's it for Focus. We want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. It is 1 minute before noon. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Let's take a look at commodity prices. A lot of green on the screen. late in the going here. In Kansas City, December wheat, 7.06 and three quarters, up 5 3/4. March, 7.23, up 4 3/4. December wheat in Chicago, 6.22, up 4. March, 6.56, up 2 1/2. December corn, 6.36 and a half, that's down 1 3/4. March, 6.48 and 3/4, down 1. May, 6.56, down 1/2. July, 6.60 and 3/4, down 1/2. November soybeans, 12.65 and a half, up 8 1/2. January, 12.73 and a quarter, up 6 1/2. March, 12.79 and 3/4, up 5 3/4. May, 12.82 and a half, up 5 3/4. October meal, 3.28.40, up 3.20. October soybean oil, 53.23, up 103.